This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, I'm Hanif Baharuddin, and you're tuned into the show that brings you closer to the people and places of our capital city. Built at the confluence of the Klang and Gombak River, Masjid Jami is one of the oldest mosques in the city with a rich history that rivals the location it was built on. Masjid Jami, or the Jami Mosque, was designed by the famous architect Arthur Benison Hubbard and was completed in 1909. Since then, it has served the local Muslim community there and has also become a witness to how the area has progressed into one of the busiest areas in town, both for commerce and as a modern transit point. But how was the area like back then? Elizabeth Kartosa from Badan Warisan Malaysia recalls the history of the place.
I think that if you look back at early modern KL, you know, and there's a lot of discussion now about, you know, who founded Kuala Lumpur and all that, and that's not really, you know, and that there are lots of opinions and lots of, you know, discussion on that, so we'll leave that aside. But in the 1850s, when tin mining became an industry that was going to be promoted here, and you have people coming up from Klang using the river system, no roads, no highways, no trains. People had to come upriver. So it took time because you're in boats, yeah? And then part of the journey is overland. And then, but in boats, when you arrive at this confluence, what you mentioned of the Klang and the Gombak rivers, that was a landing point where people would, you know, get off. And then from there, they would then use trails to get to the mining area. So what you see as roads like Jalan Ampang would lead you to the Ampang mines, and Jalan Petaling would lead you to the Petaling mines, and Jalan Batu would lead you to the Batu mine, you know, wherever the mines were. And these were trails that would lead you then. People would disembark from them. And it was also a point where you would, you know, deliver goods. And so it was a natural sort of landing point, you know, where the two rivers met. There were many different communities there by the, you know, 1860s, 1870s. You're talking about the Chinese community who made up a lot of the miners. But you're also talking about, you know, traditionally the Malay community that was already in around. And in, you know, Kampung Melayu, Kampung Jawa, Kampung Melaka. And these streets that we have, what is now Jalan Tun Perak, was called Java Street because it marked the Javanese community or people with Javanese origins. Malay Street, Jalan Melayu, it's still called Jalan Melayu, yeah? You know, would be an area that would mark where certain people, groups of people, communities are congregated, you naturally congregate to where. And the Muslim population were that side of the river, so to speak, located, you know, in communities. And there was a mosque there, which is on the side of people located at around the place near beyond the LRT station now. And it was a very simple timber structure, but it serviced the Karya, it serviced the communities who were there for their Friday prayers. But they were going to widen the road. And so for road expansion, the mosque was then relocated to the confluence. Now at the confluence, there were, apart from the landing place, there was also a Muslim cemetery there. And the cemetery was there from, I think in the more recent excavations, in the more recent developments related to the River of Life, upgrading of the landscape, several old tombstones were uncovered, yeah? And I think that's also been in the press. But if you look at photos, even from the 1970s of KL, you will see that there were, the cemetery was always there. And people who used to go to Masjid Jami would park a bit hither-thither, you know, on top of the graves, on top of the... Anyway, it was an area that was clearly populated and populated by a Muslim community. Masjid Jami itself was designed by, attributed to be designed by A.B. Hubbard, right? And I think you've had on your program, you know, people talking about Hubbard before, who did lots of other, I think, 30-odd buildings in the country, of which, you know, many of them are considered national heritage and as seen as part of this, the British Raj mark on the capital city of Kuala Lumpur. And Masjid Jamik was built, it must have been really quite a major structure given its size, the fact that it was a brick and mortar structure, not timber. You know, it had three domes, a minaret. I mean, big, you know, prayer hall. I mean, it was really grand for its time. And because it was placed on the confluence of the river and you had to cross the bridge going between the sort of the local Asian quarter and the British quarter of the Padang, right? You would see it. And I think that a lot of the nostalgic photos or old photos show this really very romantic oasis kind of thing with coconut trees and then this, you know, gorgeous looking building and larger by its time, you know, coming out of this area. And then you have this idea of the steps that were built as part of the mosque being built. I think it started being built in 1908 and it was completed in 1909 and is attributed to have been built by Sultan Alaeddin Sulaiman, whose name is after a couple of other mosques in Klang and one in Jugra. This mosque that was built there was really as a mark, the Sultan wanted it as a mark of Islam, as an official religion and very important religion, obviously, and a modern religion. I mean, you know, it was a very modern building for its time. Nowadays, we look at it and we say, ayo, you know, like dulu-dulu punya. You know, like we look at it as an old vintage or whatever, heritage, you know, historic structure. But for its time, I think we have to understand that really having this kind of brick and mortar structure was very grand, yeah. And it complemented the Sultan Samad building, which was built earlier, about 14, 15 years earlier, you know, late 1890s. And several of the buildings around, which were also with the fair face brickwork open, you know, you see the red brickwork with some mortar, with that style of, you know, dome with the style of arches, with this, you know, the chatris and the finials that go above it. So really just quite a grand place.
Of course, we cannot talk about Masjid Jamik without talking about the mosque itself. Azim A. Aziz from Atsar Architects says that, despite being designed by a British architect, the mosque drew inspirations from other civilizations.
During those days, one of the things that the British did very well is to placate and please the population by building Islamic architecture in their eyes. So as a colonial master, to win the hearts of the people back then, the architecture that they chose was Mughal and Moorish design. And the material that they use is more permanent, because they were used to more of a timber structure. So eventually, when they came in, and they built more solid sort of structures. And prior to that, they were also governing, colonizing India. So Indians' influences were also brought in their architecture. Mind you, they were British at that particular time. The architects were British, so they have to design in such a way that it is not a typical Renaissance building or typical building that is colonial. So they have to borrow the elements from these countries.
Azim also helps elaborate various other components of the mosque that were quite unique and contemporary for its time.
One thing that you can spot immediately if you are looking at mosque architecture, they are more elongated. They are not square. And you can see that most of the mosques, take it from India, they are normally three-dome mosques. That means you have a centre dome and two dome at the side. It's saf, or the prayer rows, is actually elongated. So the rows are more longer than, so that there are more people that can stand and pray in the first row, second row, third row, fourth row, rather than the squarish, which is typical of the more the Middle Eastern sort of mosque. It's more of the squarish mosque, like, you know, they take it like the Kaaba, which is also a square in shape. So you can see that they use that three-dome mosque. And also the arches are more ornate. That means you have it's more decorative rather than you have a pointed arch or a round arch. And the dome is, many will call it an onion-shaped dome. It's not your simple dome or Middle Eastern dome, but they're more onion shape. And that has been used and overused in many, many other mosques after that, the interpretation. And it's been well received. and the elements of minaret also was introduced during that time. Previously, old timber mosques never had a minaret for call of prayers. They normally used the beduk or the drum, you know, the heat, and you could hear it from afar. But during this time, they were using minarets, and several were introduced in this case.
Proper ventilation to provide a conducive environment for the congregation is also crucial, and according to Azim, Masjid Jami's design in this regard was quite progressive.
They make the spaces more open. If you can look at it, they have veranda ways that allows shade and passage. Windows and doors are actually full heights, so you allow ventilation to go through. But then I think with the introduction of electricity in the early 1900s, fan was introduced to cool down the space. Back then as well, there's not as built up as what we are now. So the heat island effect is not as bad as now. I think the increase of temperature back then and now has been quite substantial. So it becomes a little bit more hotter, you know, when we had a full house to pray, now than previously.
Maintaining an old building like Masjid Jami is never easy, but the key here is to be consistent in your approach.
It has been maintained for the last 100 over years. So I know that the dome once collapsed and they have to rebuild. I think they recently restored it. I think in my estimation, you need to, I mean, maintenance, daily maintenance, like any other things, like houses, buildings, you need to have your daily maintenance. But your major maintenance, you probably need to do for every 30 years. Every 30 years, you need to check on your electricity, your wiring, your plumbing, your even parts of the structure that you have to look at, so that whether the material that you use could last that long. There are lifespans for certain things where you have to need to restore. It can be 30 years, it can be 60 years, it can be 100 years, but there are times where you have to restore it or make a major maintenance work to the mosque or to any building.
That was Azim A. Aziz from Atsa Architects, and earlier you heard from Elizabeth Cardosa from Badan Warisan Malaysia talking about Masjid Jami. We're going to take a short break. Coming up, we're going to look at the surrounding area around the iconic mosque. I'm Hanif Baharudin, and this is I Love KL on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to I Love KL, bringing you closer to the people and places of our capital city. I'm Hanif Baharudin. We're shining our spotlight on Masjid Jami this week, and before the break, architect Azim A. Aziz gave his take on the mosque from an architectural perspective. Now, Azim has designed a fair share of mosques himself throughout his career, and Masjid Jami is definitely up there when it comes to his source of inspiration. But having said that, he also recognizes the importance to start thinking about a more modern approach when it comes to designing mosques.
Firstly, I love the mosque. It's beautiful. Architecturally, it's superb. It was ahead of its time when it was built. It's an inspiration. You can always look at that and learn from how they were building it there back then. But it's at the same time, there are elements that you can learn, use it in today's context. So in today's context, it's slightly different. We are more modern, we are now more open and more diverse. We are probably slightly more advanced in our thinking. So, and we have other new materials, new sort of technology, and then we can use that to our advantage when we design the new generation of mosques.
Okay, let's shift our attention to the surrounding area of the mosque and how it has developed throughout the years. KL has always been a trading city, and this means that Masjid Jami also organically grew as one, following the template that is consistent throughout the city. The mosque and other houses of worship around the area then naturally served the community there.
the development of sort of the more commercial aspects of Kuala Lumpur as a trading city, because it became, you had, you know, obviously you had your alongside a bigger population, you know, as your population increases, as people have an income, they want to be able to spend it somehow. You then have the development of the surrounding area to service those needs with, you know, new technology. You can build other buildings, so you have shop houses that came out, and the so-called kampung nature, yeah, of the settlement, you know, where the residential areas, you know, moved into, became more shop house architecture. And so that whole area, you know, was, and that really also has to do quite specifically with the fact that KL, you know, used to flood quite a lot and had lots and lots of fires when it was just mainly made out of timber and thatch and atap roofed structures. You know, until the early 1880s, you know, when the last big fire, you know, in 1881 wiped out all the, lost lots of lives, wiped out all the buildings. And when Frank Swettenham decided to put in new building bylaws that made sure you had buildings built of brick or more permanent structures, not timber, so not so easily combustible, he put in back lanes. When you start doing things like that, you restructure. And the commercial natures, you know, you if you were trading before, you trade lah, bawah, and you live up, you know, you live where you trade. And so you have the shop houses where people lived upstairs, and you traded whatever you needed to trade downstairs. But you always had your religious buildings. So if you look at just the old maps of Kuala Lumpur, you will see that there was a church on what is now Jalan Gereja, because there was a church there. Yeah, there's still a church on St. John's Hill, but, you know, that there was another little church on Jalan Gereja. You had a church, you had Chinese temples, you know, where the communities were. You have the Indian Muslim Mosque, the Masjid India, on Jalan, what we now call Jalan Masjid India, yeah. You know, which serviced, again, a Muslim community, but they were Tamil-speaking. So the services and prayers would be conducted in the language of that community to deal with the same. You may have the same religious obligations, but your language is different.
One thing I find quite unique, based on my observation at least, is how Masjid Jami has sort of retained its traditional role as a transit point based on the LRT lines connecting the Kelana Jaya and Ampang line. Was this done on purpose to sort of mimic the two rivers?
I don't know. That is a question you'd have to ask the mayor who decided to put the LRT line that went directly down Jalan Tun Perak despite lots and lots of protests that it was the LRT, you know, the original LRT line that went from Ampang to through Sungai Besi in that area, right? There were a lot of protests that it should not go down. That was a major street. It was a major street that had, you know, big department stores and banks and other sorts of commercial activities that were going on in the city that weren't small mom and pop kind of thing, but it was, you know, really big retail, important. It was a big face of KL. And the masjid, of course, was there. And so for the longest time, after the LRT stations came up, you could hardly get to see the masjid, actually. You know, it was kind of like behind the, you know, if you anybody wanted to find the entrance to Masjid Jamik, it was like, oh, you know, you have to go behind or through the LRT station. It was really very awkward. But in the last year, you know, with the reopening of that area, with the River of Life development, whatever one's opinion of the River of Life development is, one thing it has done is it has reopened the space and connected the space for pedestrians and for people to walk through and in a sense to enjoy, you know, the view of the mosque, even if you don't go in, to enjoy seeing it from other vantage points, shall we say, you know, from around it. I think it was pretty much blocked for quite a long time after the LRT came in. But I don't think that was I don't think that was the motivation of the mayor when he made the decision of the run of the line. I cannot say. But, you know, he's recently passed away, so.
But do you think that it is a really strategic location to have the transit point there?
Well, you have to ask the traffic engineer that. But it is, for KL, certainly a strategic point because it was a crossroads, yeah, in a sense, a crossroads between one part of the city and the other part of the city. And Java Street, if you are talking about what is now Jalan Tun Perak, Java Street became Mountbatten Road and Mountbatten Road has become Jalan Tun Perak. What you find on that street is quite a natural sort of conjunction, yeah, where different communities live, where different roads meet. Also because of the topography of the place, where it's flat, where you can make transitions easily. You know, you don't try to have to cut through a bukit, you know, and build a tunnel. You don't have to do any of that. And that's quite natural. So it is topographically, yeah, quite a natural place. So I suppose placing an LRT stop there continues, I think, in that tradition. But on the one side of the river, you know, you have a much sort of, the structure is more massive and it's more closed. But on the Masjid Jamik side of the river, it's now more open because they've kind of opened up, you know, the plaza and demolished a building that used to stand in the way.
As always, the collision between development and preservation means that it will always be a struggle to negotiate between the two. I get Elizabeth's take on this dilemma.
Well, I think that it has to do with understanding the historical context of a place. And if we understand and if authorities who are the decision makers and if agencies who are the custodians understand, you know, history and understand how history can be represented and interpreted, then we're on a good wicket. But very often people see, oh, in the middle of the city centre, must demolish because we can build high-rise, because we can make more money of it. And if the drive is not about understanding, you know, the economic and environmental balance, but understanding it only from the perspective of how much money can I make in the shortest amount of time, then yeah, it really depends on who you're talking to, you know, about whether you retain it. Imagine a situation where you didn't have the Sultan Samad building, you didn't have Masjid Jamek, you didn't have any of those buildings, you know, the old DBKL building, the Panggung Mandaraya, you didn't have the Padang, it was built on, yeah? You didn't have all those buildings in that complex around that, and you only had high-rises. You would have made a lot of money from selling, provided you can fill them up, right? But what would it have done to the story of KL? What would visitors, when they came, how would you help them understand? How do you help us understand the history of our city? By retaining it in the way it's been retained and the scale at which it has been retained, although it looks dwarfed now, if you only had, you know, the tallest thing was your coconut tree. And then on Petaling Hill, you know, near what is now MBS, yeah, the school, you have the incinerator. The tower of the Sultan Samad building is 140 feet or thereabouts high. To be built without cranes, without, you know, machinery, building your scaffolding out of bamboo, climbing and carrying everything up, you know, by hand, no mechanization. It's quite a monumental task. And in the case of Masjid Jamek, if you think about the marble that was used, the kind of tiles that were used to be put in, it was very, very grand to be celebrated as a grand and important building. These structures are markers. And I think that if we understand, not for nostalgic purposes, not for the tourists, but for us, I mean, us people who grew up in KL, who are bred in KL, or who are visiting KL, Malaysians. You know, what does it mean? You know, we talk about Kuala Lumpur. And then you go there and then it's just a high rise, right? What is it? It doesn't help us understand. It doesn't help us remember. And I think that these are, you know, really key things. Thankfully, for KL at least, you know, this area has been more or less kept relatively intact, even though on the edges of it, immediate edges of it, of course you have the high rises, but in that core, so to speak, you know, zone, it's still there. And it changed a little. Fountains, lots of fountains added, a bit of landscape added. But on the whole, it still has that sense of that place.
This is I Love KL, and this week we have explored Masjid Jami. Elizabeth Cardosa from Badan Warisan Malaysia and architect Azim A. Aziz from Atsa Architects were my guests for this episode. That's all we have for this week's edition of I Love KL. If you miss any part of the show, you can check out the podcast at bfm.my/ilovekl or download our latest app via Google Play or the App Store. Also, follow the station on Twitter at BFM Radio. My name is Hanif Baharudin, and you have been tuning in to I Love KL, bringing you closer to the people and places of our capital city. Join us again next week on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.